From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. We know that China has enjoyed a sustained economic boom, but it's also in the middle of a religious boom. An official survey shows that nearly one in three Chinese describe themselves as religious. That's an astonishing figure for an officially atheist country where religion was banned until three decades ago. Today, we begin a series about faith in China, where we examine the links between wealth and religion. Beijing recognizes five official religions: Catholicism, Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, and the first subject of our series, Protestantism. NPR's Louisa Lim has the story.
Heads are bowed as the pastor says grace at this church hall in a rural village in eastern China, the country's Protestant heartland. Hundreds huddle around circular tables to eat lunch here. It's a government-sanctioned church, part of what's called the Three Self Patriotic Movement. Today, this church is marking its annual Husband and Wife Day, a celebration of faith and community. 1,000 people from dozens of nearby villages pack into this church every week. Among them is Yao Hong. She believes it's patriotic to be Christian.
God is rising here in China. If you look at the U.S. or England, their gospel is very advanced. Their churches are rich because God blesses them. So I pray for China.
Many believers here are older. They tell stories of how prayer cured illness, of how being a Christian ended beatings from husbands, of the rewards of faith. Pastor Ni is in charge of this church. He says there's total religious freedom in China, and he characterizes relations between state and the church as extremely good.
The government never interferes with our internal affairs. There are no orders, no coercion. That doesn't exist, and we get on well.
About 30 miles away in a dusty country town, a group of women from another congregation pray ahead of a public performance they've planned for today. Freedom of religion is protected in China's constitution, but proselytizing in public places is forbidden. However, the gray areas are growing ever greater, and these women are exploiting those blurred lines. Their show on a noisy street kicks off with a folk dance. A woman in a donkey costume is being whipped by a woman dressed up as an old man. The crowd is loving it. Then, in the next act, they're hit with Christian messages. In this traditional skit, a warring husband and wife wear papier-mâché masks covering their entire heads. They argue, they come to blows, then ultimately are brought back together by finding God. The troop's unofficial leader, Wang Meizhen, describes their tactics.
We use traditional art to bring in the non-believers. It's difficult for them to walk away. Then we include Christian messages. We want to bring them to God.
Not far off, on a windswept hillside, an elderly caretaker gives a tour of an enormous newly built church, complete with its own baptism pool. This shows how the spread of rural Christianity is being helped by informal networks of rich urban Christians. This church was built with funding donated by Christians from the coastal city of Wenzhou, about 500 miles away. Wenzhou is known as China's Jerusalem. It has more than 1,000 churches, and at least 12% of the population is officially Christian. It's also one of the richest cities in China, where private business is booming. These two factors form a recent trend, the Christian entrepreneur, or as they're called here, the boss Christian. And the biggest of all the boss Christians is a man named Zheng Shengtao.
Oh, I'm Zheng Shengtao.
For him, finding riches was intertwined with finding God. His start in life was humble, delivering goods on a three-wheeled bike. Back then, private business was still banned, and in 1983, his attempts to make money landed him in jail. He picks up the story.
69天监狱，有很多这个这个帽子。
There was a charge of speculation and profiteering. I hadn't thought about Jesus much before, but I started to think about him all day long. It wasn't that I believed in him. I just prayed he would get me out as soon as possible.
He did get out after 69 days, and that convinced him to become a devout Christian. Despite his rocky start, Zheng flourished after private business became acceptable. This promotional video boasts of his seat on a government advisory body and his chairmanship of a local trade association. He's been ranked the 395th richest man in China, with assets estimated at more than $400 million. His consortium is called Shenli Group, a name which translates literally as God's power. It encompasses mining projects, real estate development, and machinery. He believes that making money is literally doing God's work.
We have to be the salt of the earth. We don't bribe officials to make money or make fake products or harm the customers' interests or evade tax. We don't think the wealth belongs to us. We're just like bank clerks. It's God who gives you the career and the wealth and asks you to manage them.
Most Christians like Zheng are literally invested in the current political system, so are tolerated, welcomed even in this part of the world. But the fact that the economic elite is pouring resources into religious activism could be unsettling for China's atheist leaders. One example is this unofficial church in the Wenzhou suburbs. A steady stream of smart imported cars drops off worshippers for a prayer meeting. The state was trying to control us, says one worshipper, who asked not to be named. So we set up our own church, not to follow the government, but to follow the God of the Bible. As the prayer meeting begins, a woman at the front of the room starts crying and praying into a microphone. Hundreds of people are kneeling on mats on the floor, weeping copiously. This is the new face of Christianity in China. Not poor and rural, but the up-and-coming urban middle classes. Their material needs have been met. Now they're seeking spiritual comfort. This is clearly a charismatic gathering. It's also technically illegal, as such sects are not supposed to exist in China. In addition, this congregation's prayer leader is not officially approved, its church unregistered. Although some leaders of bigger unofficial churches have been persecuted, the authorities largely turn a blind eye, unwilling or unable perhaps to deal with this explosion of faith. And there are now public discussions about whether gatherings such as these should be legitimized. In another act of defiance, youngsters sing religious songs and openly proselytize in a dusty rural village. A crowd of villagers is listening, perched on tractors and low benches, their feet swimming in a sea of mud. In a fiery sermon, one young missionary makes oblique references to rampant materialism, corruption, and the immense wealth gap between rich and poor. It's a message that hits home in this hardscrabble part of China.
In China, a lot of so-called atheists treat money as their god. But only in God's truth can you find real freedom.
After the performance ends, a prayer of thanks. These kids are flouting the law against proselytizing, though they claim not to be aware of this law. China's Christians are pushing back the boundaries. The authorities don't seem to know how to respond. No one even knows how many Christians there are in China today. By some estimates, there are 80, even 100 million. That would be more Christians than Communist Party members. Prayer over, the young believers climb into a trailer pulled by a tractor. They're intent on saving souls, one village at a time. Where once China's youth trundled across the countryside spreading communism, now they're spreading God's word. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
And at NPR.org, you can see a slideshow of secret churches used by some Chinese Christians and pictures of religious rites rarely seen by the outside world. Tomorrow, in the second part of our series, China's divided Catholic communities.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. For the latest in our series on faith in China, we turn now to Islam. China has an estimated 21 million Muslims who have developed their own set of Islamic practices with distinctly Chinese characteristics. The biggest difference is the development of independent female mosques with female imams, something that hasn't developed anywhere else in the world. NPR's Louisa Lim has our story.
It's 5:50 in the morning, and the call to prayer echoes from a mosque in Kaifeng. This city in Henan province in central China has an Islamic enclave where Muslims have lived for more than 1,000 years. Men and women scurry through the dark alleys to the mosque. Here in Wangjia Hutong, the women go to their own mosque, where Yao Baoxia leads prayers. For 14 years, she's been a female imam, or an ahong as they're called here, in a word derived from Persian. She stands alongside the other women, not in front of them like a male imam would. But she says her role is the same as a male imam.
The status is the same. Men and women are equal here, maybe because we are a socialist country.
She decided to become an imam after she was laid off from her job as a factory worker. She studied for 4 years, first under a female imam, then with a male imam, sitting alongside men studying to become imams. She sees her main role as teaching Islam.
When people come to pray, sometimes they don't know how to recite the Quran. So female imams are teachers. We help people learn about Islam by studying one line at a time, and we lead the prayers.
I'm just being shown a couple of plaques high up on the wall of the Wangjia Hutong Women's Mosque. And these plaques date back to the 19th century, and they're used by scholars of proof of the fact that this is the oldest surviving women's mosque in China. Like other Chinese women's mosques, it began as a Quranic school for girls. These sprang up in the late 17th century here in central China. Then, more than 100 years ago, they morphed into women's mosques. 83-year-old Tang Guiying says when she was a child, the women's mosque was the only place a girl could go to get education.
I didn't go to school when I was small. We were all too poor. None of us girls studied. But I came here to play and study. The old imam was very, very old. She was 80-something, and she had bound feet.
She's sitting in the washroom as she talks. This is where women perform their ritual ablutions before prayers. This space and the female mosque itself doubles as a social center for these women, the heart of a community. In Kaifeng, there are 16 female mosques, a third the number of male mosques. But there are things that female imams can't do. They can't, for instance, lead funeral rituals or wash male corpses. At this funeral in Zhengzhou, mourners wail as they carry the coffin through the streets, but no female imams are participating. Here, most people do support the female mosques, but there's some resistance closer to China's borders with Pakistan and Afghanistan. Shui Jingjun from Henan Academy of Social Sciences has been studying women's mosques, a phenomenon she says is unique to China.
Historically, in northwestern China, there were no female mosques. There was resistance because they thought that building female mosques was against the rules of the religion. There are some voices who still say that. But in central China and most provinces, people think it's a good innovation for Islam.
The practice is spreading, with female mosques being established in the northwest in the past decade. Female imams in China have licenses to practice, issued by the Islamic Association of China, a state-controlled body that regulates Islamic practices in the country. This is part of the anomaly that is religion in China. The atheist Chinese authorities are endorsing a practice some Muslims may find unacceptable. But others believe that when it comes to female imams, China is leading the way. Here's Guo Baoguang, chairman of Kaifeng's Islamic Association.
Given the fast development of China's economy and as its political status rises, I think Chinese Islam will become more important in the Islamic world. The developments Chinese Islam has made, like the role played by women, will be more accepted by Muslims elsewhere in the world.
In the female mosques, most of the faithful are elderly. Young women with families often don't have the time to worship, especially given the lengthy ablution rituals several times a day. Third-generation Imam Sun Chengying worries about the future.
I haven't had any students since 1996. Women don't want to be imams anymore because the salaries in the mosques are too low. No one is willing to do it.
Female imams sometimes earn as little as $40 a month, a third what they could earn in other jobs. Younger women need more to help support their families. And so it appears the future of female imams in China is threatened, not by the state, not by resistance from inside Islam, but by the forces of market economics. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
And you can find an audio slideshow of China's female mosques at npr.org.
We go to Israel now, where there's a new battle that revolves around an age-old question: who is Jewish? The dispute pits the influential American Jewish community against some of the most powerful religious figures in Israel. A delegation of U.S. Jewish leaders is lobbying against a law currently working its way through the Israeli parliament. That measure would increase the already considerable power that Israel's Orthodox Jewish establishment has over conversions to Judaism. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said recently that the dispute could, quote, tear apart the Jewish people. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports from Jerusalem.
America is only a close second to Israel in terms of how many Jews live there. And America's Jewish community is vital in terms of the political, financial, and moral support it lends the Jewish state. So when a senior Jewish delegation representing some of the most powerful Jewish groups comes from the U.S. to Jerusalem for an emergency meeting, it's serious.
We do not want to see a schism among the Jews in the United States and Israel. And this will say to the Jews in the United States that they don't have a serious place in this country, and that's unacceptable to us.
Rabbi Daniel Allen is the director of the Association of Reform Zionists of America. He says American Jewish groups are in crisis mode.
This would be an affirmative act of the Knesset to create a second class of Jewry. And therefore, it is a much more important moment in time in terms of the sweep of Jewish history.
There is a fundamental divide between Jews in the U.S. and Jews in Israel. Most American Jews belong to the more liberal branches of Judaism, the Reform or conservative movements. In Israel, the Orthodox are in almost total control of Jewish life. American Jews are upset that the conversion bill making its way through the Knesset will, for the first time, give sole control over conversions to Israel's chief rabbinate, which is dominated by Orthodox Jews. At the moment in Israel, conversions performed outside the country by the more liberal branches of Judaism are honored. American Jews fear that if power is handed over to the rabbinate, that could change. Rabbi Nama Kelman is the dean of Hebrew Union College.
Never in the history of the State of Israel has there been a law to determine the status of a convert.
The sponsor of the bill is member of the Knesset David Rotem. He represents hundreds of thousands of immigrants, many of them from the former Soviet Union, who are trying to formally convert to Judaism here. The conversion process in Israel can sometimes take years, cost thousands of dollars, and ultimately lead nowhere. Some conversions have been overturned by competing rabbis from the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities. Rotem says the point of his bill is to make the conversion process easier by decentralizing it. If the bill passes, municipal rabbis will be allowed to approve conversions under the auspices of the chief rabbinate.
I am trying to get out some parts from the rabbinical courts and to give it to the municipality court rabbis, who are much more friendly to people who want to convert.
He says the many problems with the conversion process in Israel must be addressed to simplify the system.
We are sitting on a ticking bomb. We have got 400,000 new immigrants who came from the former Russian Union who are not recognized as Jews according to the Jewish law. They are serving in the Israeli army and they are being taken as hostages today for the reform and conservative movements who are against this law with no reason.
Rotem says American Jews are using their power to interfere in internal Israeli affairs.
I am willing to talk to them. I am not willing to be a hostage. I am not willing to be threatened, and I am not willing to be blackmailed.
The bill has already passed through committee, and the next step is for it to be voted on in the Knesset. It's not clear if that will happen before or after the legislative body disbands for summer recess at the end of this week. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Jerusalem.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. For decades, China's Catholics, estimated at over 12 million, have been bitterly divided. Some worship in official government-sanctioned churches, others in underground churches loyal to the Vatican. But 3 years ago, Pope Benedict sent a letter to Chinese Catholics, the first from a pope in more than half a century. The point of the letter? To urge reconciliation. In the second part of our series on faith in China, NPR's Louisa Lim reports on how the country's Catholics are struggling to follow the pontiff's instructions.
It's early morning and Catholic pilgrims are kneeling here on the ground at the pilgrimage shrine to the Virgin Mary in Shishan on the outskirts of Shanghai. Today is a special day. It's the day designated by the Pope as the International Day of Prayer for China. And it's a measure of what it means to be a Catholic in China that in the past this pilgrimage spot has been the subject of heightened, intense security by police and security forces, sometimes stopping pilgrims from entering. This year, however, from what I've seen so far, the situation is quite different. The official procession sets off up the hill to the Basilica. White-robed priests carry a statue of the Virgin Mary. Nuns shower it with flower petals. The clergy in this procession belong to China's official Catholic Church, sometimes known as the Open Church. It cut ties with the Vatican in 1951 and has ordained its own bishops, some without the approval of the Pope. Throughout the festivities, some believers refuse to enter the government-sanctioned church on the hill. They hold their own services outdoors at the shrine. This is what's called the underground church, though this year they are permitted to worship here openly, signalling a thaw. They refuse to take communion from Beijing's officially appointed bishops, and they follow bishops chosen by the Vatican. In some parts of China, these communities are moving closer. In Tianjin, just 50 miles from Beijing, priest Zhang Liang says the papal letter 3 years ago
was a turning point.
In the past, Tianjin Diocese was divided into above-ground and underground Catholics. The two factions argued, and it was awkward when they met. But Pope Benedict XVI issued a papal letter, and now we in Tianjin have reconciled with each other.
During Mass, priests publicly named Stephen Li Sede as their bishop. He's the senior Vatican-appointed bishop unrecognized by Beijing. He himself has urged his flock to worship in the state-sanctioned church as an act of reconciliation. Father Zhang believes Chinese Catholics should take responsibility for healing the divisions themselves, instead of blaming the government.
Why do you blame the government? It's like blaming the sun for not shining on you. If you take one step forward, there's the sunshine. It's like saying, will the government let me open this door or not? The government doesn't care whether you open the door. You just think they care. Everyone is so busy prejudging, they don't dare do anything.
Just 25 miles away from Tianjin's splendid cathedral is a makeshift concrete church alongside a busy highway. This is where another underground bishop, Melchior Shi Hongzhen, spends his days. This cheerful 83-year-old is also recognized by the Vatican as a coadjutor bishop, similar to an auxiliary bishop. He says he supports the steps towards reconciliation, but he will not join the official Catholic Patriotic Association, a quasi-governmental organization that controls the Catholic Church in China.
The Patriotic Association is an organization of the country, like the Communist Party. You are free to join or not. I didn't. What I've been doing doesn't harm the country in any way. I just give Mass, baptism, and the last rites. That's all.
Despite recent moves towards reconciliation, his personal situation hasn't changed. He's under a kind of house arrest, effectively a prisoner in his compound. Believers can come and worship with him, but Catholic clergy reportedly cannot. China fears the influence of the Vatican, and this frail old man is evidently viewed as a threat. He's not keen to talk about the politics of the church in China, but it's notable that he praises Thomas More, the 16th century Catholic martyr.
Thomas More,
do you know why Thomas More was sentenced to death? Because of his Catholic faith. How amazing to have such love for Catholicism.
But even before the papal letter, things had been changing in China. Over the years, one by one, most of Beijing's patriotic bishops have secretly contacted the Vatican and received Rome's approval. That's done through emissaries like Father Marcel Michel. Now in charge of the U.S. Catholic China Bureau, he's traveled to China more than 30 times since the early 80s.
Since we were meeting priests and meeting bishops who had been consecrated bishop without the permission of Rome, you know, and things like that. See, they were telling us this kind of condemnation by Rome was the greatest pain they had in all of that. It's really painful. Some of them would say, well, I would like to write to the Pope. Would you give a letter? So this is what a lot of us were doing. So we're kind of messengers.
Now, 90% of Beijing's open bishops have been recognized by Rome. And since the papal letter, all the candidates picked by China to become new bishops have also been acceptable to Rome. It's significant, too, that despite the lack of any official ties, Pope Benedict's letter was sent first to the Chinese government before being issued to the faithful. Sister Janet Carroll is a Maryknoll nun who's worked with Chinese Catholics for many years.
There was a very careful consideration on the part of the Vatican, the Holy See, to make the letter available to the authorities in China And that really was a gesture on the part, I believe, of the Holy See to relate to the Chinese government and to let them know that it was nothing that they were trying to do, any sort of rousing up of the faithful over against their own country.
All agree that the Vatican and China are inching closer, even the man some see as the Vatican's nemesis. Anthony Liu Bainian has been called China's Pope. A former seminarian, he's in charge of China's Catholic Patriotic Association. It's an organization which Pope Benedict described as incompatible with Catholic doctrine in his papal letter. But Anthony Liu Bainian sees his post in lofty terms, saying he believes he was chosen by God.
The Lord needed a bridge between the church and China and those holding political power. And I'm a tool sent by the Lord to be that bridge.
He blames the Vatican for splitting China's church. China's position is that the Vatican must cut its diplomatic ties with Taiwan and not interfere with China's internal affairs, including its religious decisions. His view? The ball is in the Vatican's court.
China is getting stronger and richer, and the Vatican can't get away from politics. The Vatican is isolated over China's diplomatic recognition. The problem of ordination of bishops doesn't stem from the Chinese church. If there are no diplomatic ties and we want to choose bishops, how could we report back to the Vatican? If you want to solve the problem, you should have already established diplomatic ties.
Politics aside, reconciliation is easier said than done. Back in Tianjin, one believer criticized the moves as a cheat. There's confusion, too, as to what the Pope's letter actually said, with various interpretations circulating. In a different part of China, one underground nun who didn't want to give her name told me her doubts.
I'm not sure whether the Pope understands the situation of underground church people like us. If we all suddenly came out into the open, then it would be out of control. It would cause chaos for the church. If you don't know what reconciliation means, then it's better not to reconcile.
As we talk, an underground service is being held inside a Spartan bedroom next door. There's a danger the Pope's pleas for reconciliation could end up splintering the church further. And even diplomatic ties with the Vatican wouldn't solve the decades of animosity on the ground. Yet the lines between underground and open church are blurring. And China's divided Catholics are groping towards reconciliation, even if that process is slow and painful. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.